supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Acres supports You Bet Your Garden. Moss is a low-maintenance solution for shady spots where grass doesn't like to grow. Moss Acres offers information and a variety of mosses online at mossacres.com.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in the question of the week, window boxes. Almost anybody can add some gardening space to their place by hanging some boxes under their windows. But these containers are different than ones that sit on the ground. We'll tell you what you need to do with window boxes to make sure the plants stay healthy over the summer. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to hop right to your questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. At 1-888-346-9499. Rich, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Michael, and thank you.
Oh, thank you, Rich. How are you doing, sir?
Excellent.
And where is Rich doing excellent?
Downingtown, Pennsylvania.
I know it well. What can we do for Rich in Downingtown?
All right, got a phone call from my brother-in-law. He just built a brand new house, and on their property, most of the property is covered with poison ivy.
Okay.
Now, he has a few trees that he wants to get rid of, and he knows I have a wood stove. So he said I was welcome to the trees, but he had heard that the poison ivy wrapped around the tree, once you remove it, apparently it leaves oils on the tree and you should not burn that wood.
Burning poison ivy is one of the only aspects where emergency medicine enters into horticulture. People have died from inhaling the fumes of poison ivy that was accidentally burned in wood stoves and fireplaces.
Well, we will not be burning the poison ivy. That will be stripped off the tree. But the remaining wood on the tree, is that affected by the poison ivy?
Typically, poison ivy is an epiphyte. That means the vine clings to the tree, but does not take nutrients from the tree. There is no transfer of anything under the bark. So I think that if you carefully debark the wood, which I'd say certainly all professionals do before they sell firewood, I would think if you get down to that heart wood that you are mostly safe. Now, here's the caveat. The oils in poison ivy are always active, the uracil oils, so that even when the leaf is dormant, even when the tree it has been cut and the vine has been severed and the plant is technically dead, the oils are still present and still active. So the biggest caution here is hands that handle the bark. They need to be incredibly well protected. But those same hands must drop that protection and take up new protection before they then handle the wood.
Right.
Because you could transfer the poison ivy to the good wood by simply not changing your gloves during the process of debarking the wood on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are careful and you segregate your method of touching these materials, you should be fine.
Well, I am totally in agreement with everything that you have said. And having had experience with poison ivy, you know, clothes, pants, shirts, everything. Now, the next big question is, how do you kill the poison ivy before it starts to blossom or spread leaves?
You really have to do this over the course of a couple of seasons. All you can really do the first season is sever the vine down where it's coming out of the soil. Now, again, because it's an epiphyte and not a parasite, it can't take nutrition from the tree. So that vine will die. And you have to remember that this plethora of material, the green turning brown up in the tree, is poison ivy, and it's going to remain poison. In terms of individual plants sprouting out of the ground, go to our website, go to Garden Answers A to Z, go to P for Poison Ivy, and there's my detailed plan for using plastic bags instead of gloves and wetting the soil and getting the poison ivy out root and all.
We pretty much figured that we'd have to pull all the vines off and put those in a dumpster.
Not only the vines, I want you to debark the tree. When you have that nice, shiny heartwood, you should be fine. Again, as long as you haven't commingled, as long as you think of it like raw chicken and cooked chicken. You really want to keep these two things separate. All right, Rich?
Very nice. Thank you very much for that.
All right. Good luck, and thank you for reminding our listeners of that inherent danger in nature.
Love your show, Mike. You've done a great job.
Well, thank you.
Take care, partner. Have a nice week.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Kim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm calling from Beaver Creek, Ohio.
Very good. How are you? What can we do for you?
Pretty good. My daughter's getting married in the fall. It's an outdoor wedding, mid-September, and we wanted some hanging plants to kind of fancy up the gazebo.
Right.
Her colors are sangria and ivy, and I was wondering what sort of plants would work that time of year, mid-September.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you're not going to raise these plants yourself, are you?
Probably not.
Good, 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 because I always try to discourage brides from being involved in their own wedding flower growing. So many want to do it, and I just beg them not to, because there's just so much opera going on anyway that's something best left to a professional.
Okay.
Mid-September should not be a problem, with the caveat that we've lined this up, that we've had like a greenhouse or a professional grower getting these things going. And again, mid-September in Ohio, you're not going to have to worry about a freeze or anything like that. So we're still talking the plants of summer.
Mm-hmm.
And in hanging baskets, there is a type of plant that is really unparalleled. There is a category of petunias called wave petunias, W-A-V-E.
Okay.
And the first one that was introduced was a purple wave, and since then they've come out with a huge variety of colors.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they have your colors. That's obviously going to be a deciding factor.
Right.
But if they do, there is no other flower that looks better cascading down from a hanging basket. I mean, it's numbers 1, 2, and 3 on the hit parade.
All right.
It comes to mind that I have your daughter's colors in my dining room, but they are shade-loving flowers.
Oh, okay.
They are impatiens, which come in pure white. I think the kind of white she is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And although there are red impatiens as well, red begonias, not tuberous begonias, although tuberous begonias would work very well, I'm talking about the annual begonia, just the shade-loving flower that
now,
people...
this is more of kind of like a purpley pinky for the sangria.
I thought sangria was... Well, it's a very dark red.
Yeah, it's a dark red. It kind of has a little bit of a purplish cast to it.
Not
so much like the red wines.
I tell you, if you're thinking purple in any sense, we're right back to the wave petunias.
Okay, yeah.
The reason I bring up the impatiens and begonias is I actually have those in hanging baskets over the winter in my living room. We call these annual plants, but in truth, they are perennial as long as you protect them from frost.
Okay.
And these impatiens and begonias I have in my dining room, that they've become so massive they don't go out in the summer anymore. They've become like structural. to the house. And this winter, I noticed the cascading effect of the white impatiens coming down mm-hmm. into the lights that I have in the room to help the plants survive winter. Are just drop-dead gorgeous, and they're mm-hmm. the kind of plants whose flowers you go up to and you can look at for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you can find wave petunias that have okay. the kind of colors you're looking for, you should be done there, because there's not going to be anything look better in a hanging basket.
And they won't be kind of worn out from being this late in the year?
Oh, they need to be professionally grown.
Right.
They need to be started a little bit later
okay.
than the other ones. You know, hanging baskets can be beautifully full by the end of the summer, as long as they've been protected from being blasted out by full sun or going
right.
without water. You know, hanging baskets, because they're exposed on all sides, they dry out before anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they need more watering attention. I think these petunias, they have a great track record of looking good all summer if they're well cared for. Mm-hmm. And there's just no better plant for going over a side of a basket than a wave petunia.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Congratulations again, and good luck with the wedding.
Thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all the cats and kittens who listen to our show out of Salisbury, Maryland, that I will soon appear nearby at the Ocean Pines Community Home Show on Saturday, April 30th at the Community Center in Ocean Pines, Maryland. But don't you go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get the most work out of your window boxes. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
More of You Bet Your Garden in just a moment on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Beaumont at Bryn Mawr is a gracious resident-owned continuing care retirement community in the heart of the Main Line. Beaumont invites you to an exclusive hands-on presentation by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society on Saturday, April 30th. Container gardens for small spaces, followed by a special lunch in the Austin Mansion with our executive chef. To reserve a seat, RSVP at 610-526-7000. Event information at BeaumontRetirement.com. The number again, 610-526-7000.
Supporting WHYY, Backyard Farmers, offering organic products to turn your backyard into a family food producing experience. From vegetable gardens to hen houses to rainwater harvesting systems. More at BackyardFarmers.com.
Your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting, supports WHYY. I'm Eric Frame, President. Details at YourPartTimeController.com. Your part-time controller, building stronger nonprofits, one accounting department at a time.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, even if you're not short on space, window boxes can really add a lot of color and life to the outside of the home. But they're not your regular containers. They need a little bit more special care because they're exposed to the elements on more sides than a pot that's sitting on the ground. We'll tell you what to do to get the best results out of your window boxes when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jody, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Nice to meet you. Talking with you today.
It's good to talk with you, Jody. Where are you, sir?
I live in Surgeonsville, New Jersey, near Lambertville.
Oh, okay. Surgeonsville?
Yeah, it is spelled like Sargent, but here the local residents say Surgeonsville.
Okay, very good. And Lambertville is just outside of the other side of the river from New Hope. Very picturesque area out there.
Absolutely beautiful. A farming community indeed.
Now, our intern, Jessica, tells me that you are the Jody that she emailed me about. You've made a stink bug trap.
Yeah, that is correct. I was getting fed up with the stink bugs, just like everyone. I am downwind from apparently the Ground Zero area, which is like Allentown, Pennsylvania, and we have a lot of stink bugs. My experience was that I found them in a handsaw sheath. You know, we have handsaws in our carpentry business.
Right.
And we like to keep them very sharp.
Right.
By doing that, we put them in a sheath, usually made of cardboard or leather for the good ones. Mine is a cardboard one. And the stink bugs, you know, when I pulled the saw out, they came flying out with the smell.
So your stink bug trap is not necessarily designed for their summertime pestiferousness. It sounds like you've worked on a trap to stop them from coming into people's houses in the fall.
Yeah, that seems to be correct. When the actual infestation gets started around here, it's like in September when I guess they come out of the forest and they start raining on our houses, and you know, some houses get totally covered in garages. And I think that they're looking for a place to go winter, you know, at that point, that they're done all of their summer work. But I don't know for sure. I'm not with Rutgers. I'm just a guy who was fed up with them. And when I made the cardboard trap, I hung it on the siding of my house. And, on the average, in any given trap, I get 60 and 70 of them a day.
Well, your instincts about their behavior are exactly correct. This new stink bug that's been around for about a decade that has been getting progressively out of control is the marmorated stink bug. It's Asian, specifically, I think, from Korea, and they have a very similar climate where these stink bugs are endemic to our East Coast. And what they do over there is they will swarm on south-facing rock formations in the end of the summer, because south-facing rock heats up and gets nice and warm. And while they're, you know, they're insects, so the warmth dictates how much they can move. And so they're all warmed up. They have a lot of energy. Then they try to find a little crack in the rock. They go inside. They hope to find a cave where they can hibernate for the winter. So when they did come over to the United States, and you're right, they were first discovered in the Lehigh Valley area near Allentown, they do the same thing. As the weather starts to turn cold, they start to congregate on the south-facing side, especially of light-colored homes, and they look for ways in, and they're very good at finding their ways in. So your trap simulates a false front of a home, and you hang it on the south-facing side, and there's little crevices for them to get into, and that satisfies their need. They don't know that they're not under your siding at that time, right?
Absolutely, and my job at that point, once they were in the trap, was at the end of any given day, I would take it off the wall, insert it in a big trash bag, shake them out, or poke a stick in the crack, and they would all fall in the bag. And from there, I could do whatever I wanted with them.
What can you tell us briefly? I mean, it would seem almost anything you construct out of wood or cardboard that has a front and a back and a couple of openings but is otherwise solid would work well.
Yeah, it does work that way. My spacing between the two sheets of cardboard, in other words, my stickers that separate them, they're around 5/16 of an inch thick, as much as 3/8, and the space is perfect for their height. And when they stacked in there, they stacked in there very well. They enjoyed that. And indeed, it is only made from cardboard, so it's not really weather-resistant. But when I tried other materials that were weather-resistant, they didn't seem to like it as much.
Really?
Cardboard may have a smell to it or something, or I don't quite know that part.
You tried wood?
Yes, I tried thin layers of Luan plywood. Didn't work as well. Cardboard worked the best. I didn't do extensive testing, but certainly I did, you know, to a level that satisfied my needs at the time. And everyone needs a trap like this, and so I just shared it with the world, and the response has been rather interesting.
You mentioned Rutgers. Have you shown them your trap?
One of the videos that are online about it, There was an interview with myself as well as a Rutgers person that was studying them, and their primary interest seemed to be in getting chemicals, a pesticide to kill them, not in a mechanical device.
Oh, I think you played directly into their most basic instincts. Now, these are the pests that has two annoyance cycles. In the summertime, they have emerged to become a tremendous pest of fruit and vegetable gardens. But I have never seen people get more annoyed than when they come into the homes to hibernate in the fall. And this would be so simple for people to reproduce. And again, I mean, you don't have to, you know, coat the outside of your home. You know, just it's on the south-facing side. It's on light-colored homes. And what height did you hang your traps at that you got the most catch?
Well, you described them being on the south side. I experienced them on all sides because that time of the year, it's just warm out.
Right.
It seemed to be on my forested side of the building where the forest is that they came the most. But I would hang them just at my personal height, and I was able to easily remove them. I used a Velcro patch, put a patch on the wall, and a piece on the cardboard trap so I could take them off and put them on. And I tried some other stuff, lawn ones where you stand them up, but they didn't work as good as the ones attached to the house because they were really seeking at that point to find a place to hide. When I removed them from the building, behind the trap, between the wood siding and my trap, they were also back there, a little cubby space.
Right, so you could vacuum up a whole other set of them right away.
I would never vacuum them because they stink the vacuum out.
I guess that's true.
I did, in fact, set up a place on the Internet that you can look at a tutorial. It is called trapbug.com.
Really?
And I think everyone should just go there and see the video to how they make them themselves. It's a very simple video, easy for anyone to find.
Trapbug.com?
That is correct. For me, it really was accidental. I like to think of myself as forward-thinking, and I'm interested in getting rid of them just like anyone else. And it's my pleasure to share it with the world because we are about fed up with them already.
Yeah, I hear that. All right, Jody, well, thank you for your good work. Thank you for your time. And we will post that link to trapbug.com at our website.
Mike, I always enjoy your show, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for taking out some stink bugs, man.
Have yourself a good one.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Terry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
I'm semi-wonderful.
Oh, right. And where is Terry semi-wonderful?
Humphreys, Missouri. It's north central Missouri.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Terry in Missouri?
So I've got five ash trees that were planted in 1890, and they're about 4.5 feet in diameter, and they're nice trees for the yard, and the emerald ash borer's coming, and I want to know how to systemically immunize these trees, like through the bark or roots with something like chlordane.
That's not even legal anymore, is it, Terry?
No, but those bugs ought to be illegal, and there's nothing I can do about them.
There is nothing, really, you can do about them, and the best response is not to poison your entire environment. Systemic insecticides are probably the worst. I mean, think about what's going on. You're pouring enough poison into the ground for the tree roots to take up enough of it for it to get through to parts of the tree that essentially have very poor circulation in an amount that can kill a pest insect. So the amounts being used are enormous. The amount that ever gets close to an insect is minuscule. The damage you can do to the environment is massive, and it probably won't hurt the emerald ash borer. The best thing we can do against these creatures right now is the reverse, is to keep these trees healthy. That means no wood mulch underneath the tree, no mulch touching the tree, no artificial fertilization, keeping the area clear of competitive vegetation around the trees. And the real killer, the real secret, is hang massive amounts of suet feeders in the trees and surround the trees with the nesting boxes designed to attract and house meat-eating birds like chickadees and wrens and the nut thatch. If you hang suet feeders in the trees, the birds will be used to combing the trees for suet. Well, the original food of this type of bird is a pest like the boar that, you know, the eggs are laid on the tree, they hatch, they go inside. These birds have evolved to make a living off of negating these types of pests. And, of course, by dousing the area in chloridane, you'd kill every bird for 1,000 miles in every direction.
Well, now, I've got some redbud trees, but they start dying off in, like, one or two limbs a year, and then before long, the bark breaks off of them, and they die. Is that an insect, or what's causing this?
You're not mulching them? You're not feeding them?
No, I don't feed trees or mulch them either.
Okay. Well, then, I honestly can't tell you. There is nothing affecting redbuds specifically that I know of right now, but I also don't know what kind of weather you've had in Pennsylvania and many parts of the country. We had a real culling winter that delimbed a lot of trees, really stressed a lot of trees, and you know, a lot of times it's just part of a natural cycle. A tree will be attacked, lose some of its limbs and from winter and then recover, or sometimes a tree is so devastated it succumbs, or it just gets to the age, you know, where it's fulfilled its natural lifespan and it starts dying off.
Well, the biggest stress we've had is it'll warm up early in the before the spring even and turn about 70 to 80 and even 90 a couple of days ago, and then within 3 or 4 weeks it'll probably freeze again, and these trees have all put out buds and leaves, and it really knocks them for a loop.
Yes, it does, but theoretically, in most situations, if the tree is otherwise healthy, all it has done is destroy the show you get from those beautiful red buds, the heart of the tree, the ability of the tree to put on new leaves and photosynthesize them over the summer should not be affected. But I'm so glad you asked about the emerald ash borer, because I would really like to see people luring birds, meat-eating birds, to these trees. I think these birds have a greater capacity to protect these trees from this pest from Asia than anything that a human can do.
You're a herbaceous philosopher.
Yeah. All right, Terry, thank you very much, and good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am doing well, Joanne. How are you?
I am fine. About 5 years ago, we purchased a fig tree.
Mm-hmm.
We moved it outside about 3 years ago.
Now, where are we, Joanne?
In Cheltenham, Pennsylvania.
Right, which is either inside the city of Philly or a suburb.
We're
right
outside. We're the northern contiguous suburb.
Right.
Last year, we had two wonderful crops on the figs. We managed to eat the first crop, and the squirrels ate the second crop. Now, we've had several suggestions, mostly involving BB guns, but is there any way that legitimately we can get rid of the squirrels or somehow protect the tree and the fruit from them?
Squirrels are evil. Unfortunately, they're also intelligent, acrobatic, and extremely capable. The best solution for something like this, you say you have one tree or two?
We just have one.
What I would do is go out and buy one, maybe two, motion-activated sprinklers.
Ah.
These are devices. What I like about them is you buy them once. You don't have to spray any smelly stuff on food that you would hope to eat. I know people who will resort to soaking the figs in deer repellent, knowing that they'll never be able to eat them, but just to deny the squirrels.
That's no fun.
But what you want to do is get a motion-activated sprinkler or two, put a battery in its head just like it tells you to, point it at your fig trees or point them at your fig trees, hook them up to the hose, turn them on, and nothing will happen till something breaks the beam by jumping onto the fig tree. And then when it does, the sprinklers will come on and shoot cold water at them.
That's an idea.
It's very emotionally satisfying. It is one of the few things you can do. Because I tell you, if you put out things like rubber snakes or fake owls or stuff, the squirrels will take them home and use them as Halloween decorations. But no creature, deer, squirrels, groundhogs, Canada geese, likes getting hit with cold water.
Now, I assumed you couldn't cover them with mesh or anything because they just chew through that. Then I was thinking about a large chicken wire cage, but that was getting to be a bit unmanageable.
But the secret to such a cage would be complete protection. No holes in your cage. Mm-hmm. The roof would have to fit really tight. And I would buy some of those little metal stakes, the double stakes.
So they can't dig underneath
it. So they can't dig underneath it at the bottom.
The water's a good idea, though. Maybe we'll try that this year and get back to you.
You may need both.
Oh, I hate buying figs. They're so much better when they're off the tree.
Oh, no, no. Your figs are worth protecting, clearly. I think you had a good idea. I think I had a good idea. And when it comes to squirrels, just throw the whole arsenal at them. I would do both this year.
Well, I'll see how much of that I can get done.
All right, Joanne. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and give a little boost to my snow pea patches and garlic beds. Let's see. I think I'll water the garlic with a nice seaweed fish fertilizer mix. And, hey, I'll bet the pea plants would also like a little bit of that joy juice. And, hey, what the hey. As long as I got the bottle open, I'll mix up enough to feed my lettuce and spinach as well. But don't you go getting your plants off to a good start with a healthy, nutritious breakfast just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get the best results out of window boxes. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. I'll deliver a pair of free lectures tomorrow at the Health and Fitness Fair at the Newtown Athletic Club. Tomato growing at 1 and answers to your garden questions at 3. That's tomorrow in Newtown, PA. On Thursday, May 5th, I'll appear at the West Lawn Library near Reading, PA from 6:30 to 8 p.m. And on Saturday, May 7th, I'll deliver 2 free talks at the Green Fair at the Care and Share Shops in Souderton, PA. This Tuesday, April 19th, there's a free plant propagation workshop at the Cathedral Village Retirement Community in Philadelphia, and a free sustainability fair next Saturday from 10 to 2 in Palmyra Cove. That's under the Jersey side of the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
We invite you to join us today for Fresh Air Weekend. Comedian Tina Fey will talk about doing improv, working with Alec Baldwin and Tracy Morgan on 30 Rock, and also making the transition from writer to performer on Saturday Night Live. Tina Fey is our guest on Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today here on WHYY. WHYY forecast for today, rain showers and wind and possibly thunder this afternoon. The high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow we dry out. Some sun, but it will still be windy for Sunday, the high 64. Right now it's 48 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What makes window boxes different than other containers? You know you want to hang them. You know they can add some growing space to almost any place, but they require special care. We'll tell you how to do window boxes well when we get to the question of the week, right after just a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Callie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. I love your show. I'm a recent listener, just been on a few weeks.
Okay.
Keeping up on my Sirius satellite radio.
Oh, excellent, excellent. We love our listeners on Sirius. Where are you, Kelly?
I'm in Lancaster, California, in the Antelope Valley.
Okay.
On the western edge of the Mojave Desert.
So, what can we do for Kelly in Lancaster, California?
I am trying about to seed a new lawn in my sort of new house.
Right.
And I'm in the process of digging out all of my weeds. So I'm not sure if this is the best time to start a lawn. I called my ag extension office here, and they're recommending either Bermuda grass or a tall dwarf fescue. And I'm wondering if you can give me some tips on getting my fescue lawn started. It's going to be seeded under two, I think they're Chinese elms. I'm hoping it will get enough sun.
I don't even think your local extension people can figure out what works in your area, because you just named Bermuda grass one of the most popular warm season grasses, and your dwarf type tall fescue, which does seem like a contradiction in terms, but it's one of these modern fescues, that a tall fescue is a kind of a category, and dwarf means they've tried to refine it to be slow growing. But that's a cool season grass. So,
you know, I kind of mentioned that to them, but that's what all the sod farms here, we have sod farms here in the Antelope Valley, and when I called them, that's what they recommend, is a tall dwarf fescue.
So does that mean that you have cold winters?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm at about 2,800 feet, so yeah, it does get chilly here. I'm not in the low desert. I'm in the high desert.
But it's also going to get blazing hot in the summertime.
Oh, yeah. It will push upper 90s to low 100s from about mid-June through end of September.
No grass is going to be happy there. That's the bottom line. How cold does it get in the winter?
It will generally get down into the 30s. We'll push nights in the 20s. Teens are not unheard of.
Is a normal winter night 30 or 40?
20s to 30s.
20s to 30s. Huh. But you're talking about seeding.
Well, I've got gophers, and although my cats are slowly getting rid of them, I really don't want to, you know, have to pay for sod just to rip it up to tear out a gopher hole or something. I figure I'm going to be chasing gophers for a couple years yet, so I'm just going to dig them up and reseed it and try to chase my gophers out.
I think that you could have some success if you did one of two things. You would want to till up what you have out there, actually rent a tiller for this, and then rake it repeatedly till you get most of the old green weedy material away, and then do whatever you can to have a load of high-quality compost or topsoil brought up to you. Spread that about an inch thick on top of your cleared surface. Level it. Level it fanatically, and then I would strongly suggest you go with sod. Anytime you talk about a difficult climate where the grass is going to be really stressed at some point in its existence, sod is ideal. So we got two things that are going on. If it is that small an area, rent a trenching tool and drop caging material down around the outside of your lawn to keep the gophers out. I like the idea of actually laying Bermuda grass sod, which won't really enjoy your winter, but it will probably survive it. I can tell you, if you could find zoysia grass plugs or sod, that would seem to be the ideal. And the nice thing about sod is no matter what season grass it is, you can lay it spring or fall. So you can get it together. You could either put zoysia plugs out there this spring, you could lay Bermuda grass sod this spring, or you could lay the tall fescue sod this spring. Your lawn, by definition, is more artificial where you are now than in almost anywhere else. So you got to make some trade-offs. If you want that feel, if you want that look, then you can give the fescue a shot. I would sod it this spring, but make sure you can buy matching seed.
Okay.
You can lay your fescue sod, and then you can overseed the natural bare spots that are going to occur as the result of your summer every fall. Now, you won't have to do that with the zoysia grass or the Bermuda grass.
I've not heard of anyone planting zoysia, but maybe I'll consider Bermuda grass again.
What you have to do now is you have to pick which kind of grass. You got to get it in, and then go to our website, go to Garden Answers A to Z, read the lawn care instructions, And just remember to follow the path of your grass, whether it's warm season or cool season, not where you live.
All righty.
Okay?
Thanks so much for your help. Appreciate it.
All right, Kelly.
Have a great day.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good, and I'm in Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
Good man. He knows the drill.
Mike, I got a question for you. For some years, 15 years or so, I've had a group of rosemary bushes growing between the driveway and the brick wall of the house facing south. These things have survived for all these years, but, you know, with our winters, they get beaten up a little bit. And particularly this past winter, they got beaten up. What I'm trying to figure out is there an ideal time to actually really prune these things back to get new, fresh growth on them?
Well, typically, without damage, rosemary needs no pruning whatsoever. I am shocked, delighted, and jealous that you are growing your rosemary outdoors through the winter safely and have done so for years. Because, you know, technically, you're either on the cusp, or most people would identify you as an area where the rosemary would not be expected to survive the worst of winter.
Right. Well, if I plant it anywhere else, it won't survive. I mean, in the odd winter, it might. But other than in this protected spot, I would not expect it to survive.
Good man. Good man. I think you've and I'm sure your soil must drain well, because rosemary hates wet feet.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate that.
But you are correct. The protection that your plant is getting has kept them alive.
But some of these have gotten so big that I really...
Oh, now you're bragging, Joe. I'm leaving. That's it. All right. So here's the deal. Rosemary technically doesn't need to be pruned, but of course everybody who grows rosemary prunes it all the time because we're harvesting it for cooking. I hope you use it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. So the harvesting essentially is the pruning. What I'm going to suggest to you is you leave it alone until like our last frost date, like May 15th, when people start putting their tomatoes out. And then if you have, and this is very typical on rosemary, some winter damage where the whole branch just turns brown, remove that branch entirely from the entire structure of the plant. Are you trying to reduce these shrubs in size?
Yes, because they're kind of getting in the way of the car.
I understand. So what you want to do is you want everybody to know that there's going to be rosemary gifted to them. And, you know, figure 6 weeks, divide what you want to do, what you want to remove into six sections, and do 1/6 each week. Never taking off too much, never shocking the plant, but doing it every week. Now, this will have two beneficial effects. It'll be very good for the plant. It's the best way to remove large amounts of material from an evergreen is gradually. Plus, you won't have a bushel basket of rosemary that'll make it look like nobody wants it. You can give bunches to people, one person a week, until you're all done. But then don't prune it once we get into the heat of summer or as we start to get into the fall. All of the work should be done soon after the plant begins actively growing again in the spring. And you can do this every year.
Good, good. Well, let me ask you another question. Along the same line, we have an irrigation line right there. Is there a risk of, killing them by turning off the irrigation there? Do they sound like they really need it?
Yes, because they have survived. And you've had the irrigation going?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
For years.
Why are you trying to seize defeat from the jaws of victory?
Well, I have the inveterate temptation to
Gardeners
tinker.
Just love doing this. I've had great success, and I've got to figure out a way to stop that. All right, Joe.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, don't change it.
See ya.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Let's work up some window boxes. Vic in Media, PA writes, we'll be building a window box to mount on a deck rail. How much drainage should be provided? The box will be exposed to whatever rain comes along. Well, the answer is a lot, Vic. Although window boxes do differ from other containers in a few ways, which we will explore shortly, their basic need for excellent drainage is the same. That means lots of nice-sized drain holes in the bottom of the container. I heat up the tip of an old Phillips head screwdriver and use it to poke extra holes into the bottom of plastic boxes. Those things never seem to come equipped with enough of their own, and I use a power drill for wood. If you're worried about little bits of doit escaping, line the bottom of the box with window screening or hardware cloth. And make sure the box doesn't sit flush to the deck rail. Those holes need to be able to drain. But that's only half of the good drainage equation. Soil mix counts for a lot. So no garden dirt in your boxes. And none of this cheap, heavy, quote, potting soil I'm seeing that's sold in generic-looking bags at ridiculously low prices. I picked one up recently and it felt more like liquid brick. Fill your containers with 3/4 of a loose, light, soil-free mix, a.k.a. professional mix, and 1/4 compost. Don't use soil-free mixes that contain junk like chemical fertilizers or water-holding crystals. Mixes enhanced with natural nutrients like worm castings are fine. And don't put no rocks, pebbles, peanuts, or other trash in the bottom to, quote, facilitate drainage. Your plant's roots want to be able to wiggle into compost and soil all the way down. We move on to Sarah in Chestnut Hill, who writes, we have lovely window boxes on the sunniest side of our row home, but I killed most everything I put in them last year. It all burnt up. I think my problem was waiting until May to begin planting. The, quote, boxes are wrought iron holders, to which we have to add a liner to hold the soil and plants. What's the best material to use? Shaped moss, burlap, wood, clay? We understand that we should use the same non-soil mix you recommend for other potted plants, correct? And should we water window boxes like you recommend for a lawn or more frequently? Well, your problem was not timing, Sister Sarah. It was that unrelenting sun cooking your poor plants. In a hot and sunny summer, every plant except maybe sweet corn would love some afternoon shade. And your problem is compounded by the fact that most window boxes leave their hinders hanging up in the air, ensuring the maximum amount of drying out in the shortest possible time. That makes your choice of liner material absolutely crucial. Now, nothing looks better than those naturalistic liners made of materials like peat moss, core, or burlap. But nothing dries out faster either. Hanging baskets and window boxes that use these kind of liners often need to be watered more than once a day, a chore that quickly gets tedious and makes even a weekend getaway in the summer an exciting horticultural adventure. I have several big wrought iron containers like yours, and the ones I've lined with core or a burlap-like fabric are placed only where they're going to get a few hours of sun a day. The ones I have in the sun either have wooden boxes in them to hold the soil and plants in place. The rougher the wood, the better this looks. Long plastic window box-like containers, a row of plastic pots, or a combination of the above. My nicest current wrought iron window box has a plastic pot at either end with an old rough wooden box in the middle that was used to ship bottles of Italian wine. I just gathered up a whole bunch of cans, pots, and boxes and kept moving around inside the holder until it looked right. With your full sun exposure, make sure you also only use plants that can take a lot of bright light. No impatiens or begonias out there. Use only wood, plastic, or metal inside your frames. Fill those containers with half compost and half soil-free mix to gain a little more water retention than my usual recipe. And mulch the surface with shredded fall leaves or dried clippings from an herbicide-free lawn. Then you should be able to achieve the maximum time between waterings. Oh, and your plant shouldn't burn to a crisp either. That's always a plus. We conclude with Jim, who says he's right here in Philly. He writes, I'm looking to construct a few window boxes to go around the perimeter of my small deck. I was planning to grow herbs, but my girlfriend wants more serious vegetables like tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants. Is this feasible for the volume of soil I can support in boxes that are 12 inches deep, 10 inches wide, and 4 to 6 feet long? Well, in other words, Jim, you're making really skinny raised beds. I like it. Those boxes sound perfect for herbs, eggplants, and peppers. I'd mix some small flowers in there as well to attract pollinators and just for nice. You could try a tomato plant, but you'd have to stick with varieties that are bred to stay small. Look for patio or bush-style plants. And be prepared to give up a space that could hold two or three smaller edible bounty producers. Oh, and be sure to use the boxes to grow lettuce, pansies, and spinach in the spring and fall. They sound perfect for cool season salad production. Well, that sure was some good advice about window boxes now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can carefully consult the print version of this and every question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put me in a box if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line. And why don't you check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website. It's getting lonely at youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters from the land of the savage servers are Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, hopes she won't have to live in a box after college. Desperately seeking some sunshine is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is the well-drained Al Banks. I'm hanging on a window ledge, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. What do terms like permaculture, biodynamic, and biointensive really mean? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll help you decide which growing philosophy you'd most like to follow. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike, with his whimsical way, works wonders with wisteria, walnut, and weeds on You Bet Your Garden Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY.